Episode 66 of the Book Exchange podcast now falls upon you like a hammer. Welcome, everybody. It is time for another episode of your favorite podcast in which Twin Virgils take you on a guided tour through all books books and literature and as many corners as we can hit, as two mortal twin brothers can hit. So welcome to all. Like I said, this is episode 66. I'm going to mention the topic in a second. My name, first of all, is Jude Lovell, and I am one of the co-hosts and co-founders of this show, coming at you from the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, as per usual. And I'm now going to take a minute and greet my co-host and co-founder of the Book Exchange podcast, my twin brother, John F. Lovell. John, are you with us?
Yep, I'm here. Hello, hello. Hello to you. Hello to all the listeners. You said we're not going to cover every book, but we're going to try before this podcast, you know, expires.
We're going to damn right
see if we can cover the entire canon. Globally,
we're going to get to everything. Yeah, yeah.
Let me turn off the irritating bleeps on my phone here. Okay, but yes, I'm here.
Cool. I usually do not remember to turn off the little things, and today I did. So, you know, between the two of us, we, as per usual, we eventually get there. So, I don't know, John. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice. I'm ready to go today, and I'm really enthusiastic about this topic.
Nice.
Ironically, you know, so we're today, the name of today's episode, we batted this around a little too. And we can even talk a little bit about why we settled on this name, not at length, but the name of this today's episode is officially Unforgettable Short Stories. So, you know, I say it's a little bit ironic because I'm really excited about this topic, but not everybody, as we've discussed before on the show many times, is into short stories. There's a lot of people that say they don't read story collections or I don't do stories. You know, I think in my life there may have been a brief window where I wasn't into them, but not much. And once I really got into reading short stories, you know, they're just as infinite, you know, as broadly, you know, colored as anything else in the rainbow. So this is a topic that, you know, but nonetheless, not everybody does short stories. And also, we're talking about short stories. We had at least one episode where we talked about short stories as a craft and kind of the art of the form. This is not that episode. And we've had plenty of other episodes where we talked about story collections that we really liked. Just in our last episode, episode 65 on science fiction, there was at least one short story collection that was mentioned by you. So Exhalation by Ted Chiang.
Right.
And so, you know, it's an interesting subject, but what we're not going to be doing is talking about the whole form like we did one other time. We're not going to be talking about our favorite. These are not our favorite short stories in the world necessarily, although some of them, if not most of them, are some of my very favorites. But that's not the phrase we wanted to use. What we're talking about today is close contender for the title was Indispensable Short Stories, but we settled on Unforgettable. These are stories between the two of us that we have read and basically just couldn't get out of our mind ever since we read them. In some cases, we've read them a ton of times. In some cases, we've read them only once or twice, but they stayed with us. And we're going to talk about which stories those are. I'm going to turn the mic over to you in a second and why they like stood with us for so long, why we think they're so unforgettable. So let me take a breath. That's our topic. What do you have to say by way of, you know, entry into this subject today? And how do you feel about it? Are you into it?
Oh, totally into it. And as I was saying to you before we were, you know, getting ready to go here, like I was into the topic when you suggested it. This was one of your suggestions and I thought it was a good idea, but it was just one of these episodes where the preparation was so much fun that you almost wanted to kind of wish we had a second part right after this and then like a third part, because there were more stories that kind of stayed in my memory than I had realized, number one. And we're going to probably at some point we'll go through.
Me too.
Yeah. You know, obviously our short lists and our longer lists. But you know, it was just fun to kind of revisit some of the ones that I had remembered that really stick out, and then revisiting them and maybe seeing how they might strike you slightly differently. Or maybe they didn't strike you as hard the second time as they did the first time. Whatever the case may be, it was just a lot of fun preparing for this one. Now, you mentioned that I think it was back in the, I'm going to say mid-20s in terms of episodes, 20-something. You can look back in the archives where we had a general episode on the short story. And we talked a lot about why we appreciate the form and you know, who some of our favorite purveyors of the form are. So we're not going to repeat all that. I think your setup was really good. These are just the ones that, for whatever reason, and we'll get into the reasons, you know, you just, like you said, they're unforgettable. You just, and for me, it was kind of like, I just sat down. I was like, I just like considered this topic and let stories come into my mind, you know, kind of just see what showed up. And that's more or less what my list is, are just stories that just immediately came back to my head, and we're going to get into why that is. But that was fun as well. So, yeah, I think for two book nerds, you know, who do appreciate short fiction, and it's a real art form, as we'll talk about. But, you know, it was just we just had a blast preparing. So hopefully you guys will have a good time listening.
Yeah, yeah. There are many stories on my list that were so memorable that didn't make sort of like my final list. There was one story in particular that I couldn't bring over to the final list. We'll talk about it. Why that I was almost literally like, you know, somebody was dragging me away from this story with my nails scraping the floor, you know, like, yeah. I really wanted it on the list. So that I agree with you. One of the cool things about the prep was how many stories came back that were really unforgettable. And, you know, perhaps just to come at this another way, around the time, somewhere near the millennium, like either right around 2000 or perhaps the late 90s, there was an anthology that came out that was edited by two of our favorite writers. And one of them is one of our favorite short fiction writers by a million miles. We dedicated a whole episode to him, Jim Shepherd, who happens to be friends with Ron Hansen. They edited a short story anthology called You've Got to Read This. And it was like the same premise. That's like another way to say what we're trying to do this in this episode. These were two writers who went to other writers and said, what is the story that you said? You immediately turned to somebody else and said, you got to read this, you know? That's what we're talking about today, like stories that we're saying all these stories that we mention. I don't want to speak for you, but like all these stories that we mentioned, at least in our main episode today, we're basically saying go find this and read it, you know. So that's where we're coming from today. These are the short stories we read that, like, you know, if you're not into short stories, or you just don't get it with the form, or you don't believe us or whatever, check out some of these stories we're going to talk about today and see if you don't get something out of it, maybe that you didn't expect to get out of it. So,
right. There's one other thing I wanted to say too. I forgot to.
Yeah,
say
sure. It. Go ahead.
I don't know if I'm preempting anything you were going to bring up, but
who cares?
One of the so everything you just said, I agree with, and it's true. And like, yeah, that idea, or that sentiment, or feeling, you've got to read this. That basically is a criterion for this show, at least right from where we're coming from. But I will say one of the other things, because there, you know, people who follow literature or do a lot of reading, you know, like there are some short stories that are very, very, very well known as being one of the greatest examples of the craft, you know, very, very famous, kind of like over-anthologized, you know, like, Hills Like White Elephants, for example, from Fitzgerald, or you could rattle off some of
Hemingway. Hello.
Yeah. Hemingway. Well, I was just testing to see if you're as energetic and awake as you said you were. So congratulations. Yeah. Well, Hemingway. Thanks. Hemingway. It's so famous. I forgot the writer, but right, you know, Hemingway, or, The Gift of the Magi by O. Henry. And, you know, so I just want to say that, like, I kind of tried to stay away from, you know, there are some stories that popped into my mind that are incredibly memorable, but, like, you know, have been anthologized to the hilt And so I kind of gravitated towards stories that were maybe a little bit lesser known. This is the only kind of thing that I'll say. Not in every case necessarily, but that was one little guiding criteria for me.
That's a great point. Yeah, and I tried to too, but I failed on a couple of occasions, and we will get to those because there are some stories that are just so good that, you know, that's the reason why they're anthologized. But by and large, though, I think we're both of us. I you know, being behind the scenes here, I got a preview of John's list. It's awesome. You know, there's a lot of stories that go kind of well out there, so it's going to be great. So let's transition to some very brief table setting / admin. Then we'll get to what we're reading. And then I'm going to lay some ground rules, John, for how I want to approach this. And, you know, like in most other episodes, we're going to approach it with a lot of leniency. You know, we don't want to put too many parameters around it. We kind of let it go where it's going to go. If we run out of time, you know, so many books, so little time. So we're going to approach it that way. So administratively, please reach out. Tell us how we're doing. Give us a positive review on any place that you listen to the Book Exchange podcast, Exchange with an X. We appreciate it if you take a few minutes to give us a positive review, stars, whatever. So do that if you feel so inclined, if you like the show. Reach out to us. Email address is bookxexchangetwins@gmail.com. Tell us what you like about the show. Tell us what you want us to cover. Give us ideas. Speak about what's on your mind if you want to. So I want to just open that door once again to all our listeners. We're very appreciative of all of you that join us around the world in as many as 29 countries, which I just counted up recently because I like to stay on top of that. So please do that. Reach out to us. Thank you, one and all, for listening. John, if you don't have any administrative note yourself, if you do, hit it now, and if you don't, why don't you talk to us about what you're currently reading?
Okay. No, I don't have any extra administrative notes. Sorry for that echo. Hopefully it'll dissipate. And I know you don't hear it when the echo does show up, but it tends to actually stay on the recording, so our apologies for that. It's out of our control.
That's just the indicator that you're way out there on the coast, you know?
That's right. That's right. I'm out here in the hinterland. So I mentioned this book at the end of our last episode, and I'm currently, you know, waist deep in it. It's a book called The Anarchy, The Relentless Rise of the East India Company by a historian named William Dalrymple, a British historian. It's actually Scottish, but historian. Who has written this very thick and fascinating history of the exploits, and I use that term on purpose, the exploits of the East India Company and their kind of long and sordid history of exploitation in the country of India. And you know, that the entire history of how that came to be, you know, I'm kind of in the middle of it now, so they've basically kind of taken over the country and through, you know, much greed and violence and rapaciousness and all kinds of other good stuff. You know, they're in the section I'm reading now, there's a massive famine across the country of India, and they continue to just tax the hell basically all the residents there and just, you know, exploit them for their own profit. And this went on for, you know, at least two centuries. But this is a fascinating and kind of, in some ways, a sordid story of how, you know, essentially a trading company, you know, a commercial enterprise, what we would call a big, you know, major corporation now, came to essentially run a country, you know, half a world away. How did that happen? And it's fascinating how this story continues to have resonance even in our own time with the kind of sway and pull that some of our major corporations still seem to have even within our own government. So it's very much still a relevant story, but, and a fascinating one, as I said, but a sad and tragic one too. So it's just one of these histories you read, and you just almost every page you just can't believe what you're reading, and yet you know Britain was firmly in charge in India for, like I said, a couple centuries, and just made billions and billions of pounds or dollars at whatever currency you want to use. They made a ton of money there until it finally fell apart. But man, it's a really, in some ways, it's a very disheartening story. But as I said, in a lot of ways, it still has resonances today. And Dalrymple is a very skilled writer. He's able to write clearly. You can follow the action, even though there's a lot going on across different parts of the country. And you're just kind of shaking your head the whole time. You just can't believe how this all came to be. So it's a really gripping book of history, but not necessarily always a very sunny or positive one. So, but I'm learning a lot from it, and I'm, kind of gripped by it. So that's what I'm reading.
Well, there's some nonfiction books I'll just, go on record here on the show that John reads where I wouldn't say I'm out, but I'm like, man, that's too John for me. That's like way out there. This one I just love. I'm not even sure why. I'm a little bit of even more than you, John, of kind of an Anglophile and interested in Britain and British history a little bit. I don't know if that's really what's driving this, but I just, I don't know. Like, it's just so, it's fascinating, that it's like sort of an early version of one of the huge, corporate conglomerates that kind of rule the world now, whether it's Apple or, Meta or whatever, not in terms of technology, but just in terms of how culturally, monolithic it is, or Standard Oil or something like that. And, every time you go anywhere into either nonfiction or British literature or history or historical novels, the East India Company is like in there somewhere. I don't know what it is, but I just think that's a really fascinating subject for a nonfiction book, like a big meaning nonfiction book like that. And it really sounds like it's an interesting read to me. So, kudos for that.
Yeah, there was just one kind of throwaway line in the book, but it just was kind of indicative of how kind of interesting the story is, and the author was talking about, and this was in the introduction, about how there are so many words that remain in the English language that have Indian origins, and it basically traces back to this relationship between Great Britain and, because we speak English here in the United States. So it's like, I can't remember any of them now, but like pajamas is one of them. That's from that word has its roots in India. And there are many, many other words that we just take for granted and we use, but they are the result of this kind of twisted relationship between not even the British crown necessarily, but this British corporation and an entire subcontinent of people, which includes many, many different races and languages. And it's crazy that there's still lingering, lingering aspects of it that remain in everybody's mind, but we don't realize where even these words came from and how they came to be part of our language. So it's really incredible.
Yeah. I mean, we'll move off it, but nations that have colonized other nations, that concept is as old as time, right? Like the Vikings and all that stuff. But there's something about British colonization, maybe from, 1800 to, 1950 or something, some kind of big period of world history, that just kind of the ramifications and the consequences and, byproducts of that nation colonizing those many places across this planet is just this whole fascinating topic into itself,
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Including all of our own national story,
Right.
So anyway, that's a great pick. I'm just going to talk briefly about the book that I'm reading because we do have a lot to cover on Unforgettable Short Stories. I am reading a book. I love the book I'm reading. I'm a fiction person, as I've said over and over. I'm immersed about two-thirds of the way through a novel maybe three quarters, by somebody who's rapidly becoming one of my favorite writers. I've talked about him a lot on the show. He's an Australian writer named Tim Winton. And I discovered him. I discovered Tim Winton. I sort of took a flyer on one of his books many years ago. It's still one of my favorite novels of the last 10 years. Definitely. It's called Cloud Street. It's kind of a saga of two families living in the same house in Australia, where Tim Winton is from, the western coast of Australia. Born and raised in the western coast of Australia. He's written a lot of different novels and short story collections. He's written some kids' books. There's a really cool movie that just came out on Netflix called Blueback, which is based on a kid's book that Tim Winton wrote about the Australian coast and the relationship between a small child and a big blue fish. You know, so the book I'm currently reading is called The Riders. Seems like a little bit of a departure from other Tim Winton books in that it's all of his books concern Australia, and all of his books are about men. He's kind of a male writer. There's plenty of women and relationships with women and with female characters that are strong in his books, but his books are really about men and their struggles and broken men in particular for one reason or another. This book happens to be about – it's about a man who goes from – who's recently, you know, or a few years into a marriage. He has a 6 or 7 year old daughter and a baby on the way. He goes to he takes his family. He's kind of a free spirited man who's like following the career path of his wife. But they decide that they're going to leave Australia and move to like a rural part of Ireland. Sort of spontaneously, they buy this small house. They're going to renovate it and they're going to live for a while in Ireland. It's not fully explained why they decide to do that, but there's a little bit of a free spirit, bohemian, risk-taking, adventurous streak through both of them. So the man precedes his family to Ireland, his wife and daughter. And early in the book, he works for a while in the house. He's really doing his best to renovate it, and he hopes they really are happy with the work that he's done. Goes to the airport in Shannon, Ireland to pick up his wife and daughter, and only his daughter gets off the plane, and she's like 6 or 7 years old. The rest of the book is him trying to find his wife without having any idea of why, and she's pregnant, why she left her, why she essentially put her daughter on the plane and sent her without going herself. And so that's the rest of the book. I haven't gotten to the resolution of that yet. This guy is trying to figure out what went wrong and what happened. And it goes to a few different places. He's trying to figure out where she might have gone. They had a little history in Greece. So he goes to Greece. He takes his daughter with him and they go looking for her. He goes to Greece and they spend some time in Greece and have some adventures there. And then I think eventually it's heading back to Australia for whatever the resolution is. I love Tim Winton's books. I think he writes like, if you like writing, if you're okay with books that are sort of more, a little bit more focused on men and their thoughts and their issues or whatever, and you like a book written by somebody who has a lot of heart and compassion for humanity, he writes a lot about love and he writes an awful lot about the beauty of nature. So this is a book I'm really enjoying. I think he's a great writer. So just big shout out recommendation of Tim Winton's books, and we'll leave it there.
Well, that sounds pretty boring, Jude. I gotta tell you, like,
all right, well, it's not.
This is unfiltered. No, I'm joking. That actually sounds like pretty cool, because I didn't realize it almost has, because you told me a little bit about the book, but the way you just described it there, it's like sort of a mystery.
Right? Like, yeah.
It's a mystery story, which is kind of interesting coming from Tim Winton, who you know better than I do. But, you know, even like in genre wise, it seems like maybe a little bit different than what he's done with other books. But you just have no idea. I mean, I'm kind of like, I hear that setup and I start asking questions like, well, what did the mother tell the daughter when she put her on the plane? You know, what did she tell her to tell the father? You know, it's all kinds of questions. So pretty interesting setup there. But Winton is a gorgeous writer too. So if you add, you know, intriguing setup plus how beautifully he can write, that sounds like a really good book.
Yeah, so. It is so far. Yeah. One of the things is, that stands out in the, or that's interesting in the book, is that he has this really close relationship with the little girl who looks like him and has kind of a similar spirit to him. So they have this, you know, and I have two daughters and you have a daughter and,
right,
you know, there's not, and this book, you know, goes to great lengths, I think appropriate lengths to, you know, make it clear that there's something really special about being close to your little daughter. Right. And, right. But when she gets off the plane, she won't talk. She doesn't talk for over like half the book. So, which is totally uncharacteristic. So
Wow. That's
another element of mystery in it. And, you know, it strains his patience, but it's a great book. It's called The Writers. Still getting to the bottom of that title. And then just Tim Winton in general, recommend him. And, so that's that for reading.
Sorry to interrupt, but I can't imagine, you know, you mentioned this is also a father-daughter story. So I can't imagine being in that situation where my daughter gets off the plane and then she won't talk to me for 3 days. Like, I think I'd go crazy. Like, cause.
Yeah. Like as a 7-year-old, you know.
Yeah. Like, it's like, tell me what's awful. Going on. Yeah. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. But yeah, we'll move on.
Okay. So, if we're ready, I'm going to kick it off, John. We're now the topic is unforgettable short stories, according to Jude and John Lovell. So, you know, gird your loins or whatever. And so here's how I'm going to do this. I would like to. I know how we roll. So this may not work. I would like to try, since my short list. You mentioned that towards the end we'll try to hit the longer list and at least mention some other titles. But my short list, short in quotes, is 9 stories. And I think you have like a similarly sized list. And they're short stories, so we don't have to spend, you know, a long time on each one. So the way that I would like to do this, if you're game, is I have a little four-item list of what I want you to cover. Then I'll go first and try to do it myself, and then you follow my lead, if that works for you.
Okay, I better get my pen out and write down these. What I'm supposed to
well, write. I've got it here if you need reference to it, so
okay.
No worries.
That's fine.
And again, we're going to be lenient with ourselves, but here we go with the unforgettable short stories. I'm going to start in just 1 second, and I'm going to give you the name of the story, number one. I'm going to tell you who wrote it, number two. I'm going to tell you what year it was first written, and if you don't know, that's fine. You can approximate it. You know, it was written in the 50s or whatever. Who cares?
Okay.
And number four is, why is it unforgettable? So that can involve like a really short recap of the story. I, you know, anticipate that it will, at least for my first one. I'm going to at least give a short recap so people know what it's about. But you could also just cut immediately to, there's one other story I'm just going to cut immediately to why it's unforgettable. Well, I'm going to tell you. So you handle number four the way you want to. Any questions on those 4 points, or can I just like kick it off?
No, just go ahead. Kick it off. I'll do my best to follow the format.
Okay. And if you need me to read it to you, I've got it here. All right.
I don't have quite as many stories on my list as you do, but it's like I have about 6.
But okay, so you know, if I need to just mention a couple again, that's fine too. I mean, people are going to get the idea. You're going to get a lot of cool stories out of this episode.
Okay.
So my first story, I've been dying to talk about this story almost since we started, and you know where I'm going. Almost since we started this podcast, and it's called A Distant Episode. That's the name of the story. The person who wrote it is somebody named Paul Bowles, who was a kind of an obscure English writer from the middle of the 20th century. I would not call him like one of my favorite, you know, writers of all time. But this is certainly one of the craziest stories I've ever read. So, Distant Episode, it was written by Mr. Paul Bowles. It was first published in 1945. So that, you know, places it squarely in the middle of the 20th century. This is why A Distant Episode is kind of unforgettable to me. It is a story, a relatively brief story, about a professor of languages who's traveling in the Middle East, kind of a fictional part of the country of, I believe it's Morocco, might be Algeria, but it's like Northern Africa. Basically, in this story, A Distant Episode, this guy is on his own traveling in this part of the country. He shows up somewhere – where he believes an old friend of his is still living from who was integral to an adventure he had had in the past. So he shows up in this town, this small town in this fictional area of Northern Africa, looking for his old friend. He goes into a cafe and inquires about him. He gets a very hostile reception from the local man, like the Muslim man who's running the inn, who says, well, he's dead. So, you know, you kind of forget, pardon my French, but like shit out of luck, you know. And this is all at the very beginning of the story. And then he's like, okay, well, you know, maybe I'll order some food or whatever. And he basically gets a freezing cold and increasingly hostile reception from this guy. And then the man who's running the inn says that he will take him to somebody through the village to somebody who may know, you know, the whereabouts of where he was, or I don't even totally remember, but like give him a guide to, you know, guide him to like some people who can help him get to the next place or whatever. Brings him out behind the cafe, leads him into the dark. And increasingly they find themselves like wandering into basically wilderness in the middle of this foreign country. Then the professor slowly realizes that this guy is up to no good. He leads him into the hand of these like smugglers or like bandits running through like the back, you know, mountainous regions of this country. They take him from the innkeeper. I remember there's a unforgettable line in the story when they're still out of the way out into the wilderness and the innkeeper says something like, you know, keep your voice down or don't turn on a torchlight. He says the foreword sentence, here are bad dogs. For some reason, I remember that sentence. Here are bad dogs. So he leads them out into the dark. He basically delivers them to these like bandits. These bandit people in this foreign country take this professor and they kidnap him and keep him as like their prisoner, wandering around into increasingly desolate wilderness. Then they do a series of basically torturous and insane things to the professor and turn him into kind of like a circus freak exhibit and take him around to other towns and like put him on display for like people's entertainment. Then this short story just rapidly fast forwards over many, many years. And this guy is just like a totally dehumanized freakazoid who's been like victimized by these foreign bandits in another country that he doesn't know anything about. And at the very end, he tries to make an escape and he kind of runs off into the distance and heads in towards the wide open desert of Africa, just kind of going nuts. And that's the story. <You know? laughs> A distant episode. It is one of the craziest stories I have ever read. It is one of the most atmospheric stories that I have ever come across. Like you're about two paragraphs into it. Things go kind of sinister and they just get darker from there. I have no idea what the aim of this story was or what there is some, you know, broader theme seems to be happening around like language and communication and stuff. But this story is just absolutely bananas. And I don't really know what to make of it. That's all I'm really going to say. I never forgot it, but there's an image at the end where, not to give too much of a spoiler, but you know, this professor is just transformed into another thing, almost barely human. You know, he's been tortured. He's got weird clothes. And he decides to just make a break and run out into the middle of the desert. And there's a soldier that sees him and says in French, "Tien, a holy maniac." Which Tian means like, look, or check it out, a holy maniac. He says to his buddy, standing up on the wall with a cigarette or whatever. And the guy just goes running off into the oblivion. And for my money, I was assigned to read this in grad school. I can't think of any story I've ever read that's as crazy as this. It's definitely worth reading. It's like, you know, very sinister, very dark, very troubling, very unforgettable. So that's my first one, is a distant episode by Paul Bowles. So like, you know, I started things on like a sunny note.
Yeah. Yeah. Very sunny. Isn't he like, cause I read the story too, but it's been a long, long time ago. When they see him and the guy says, look, a holy maniac, isn't he sort of like gibbering into the air?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to give it away too much, but he's like, just kind of, I don't even know how to say it. He's just kind of like spazzing out, yeah. running off into like it's a flight of total madness, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's and fascinating.
Some of the effectiveness of the end is how he's like sort of, I don't even want to say dressed, but like, you know, sort of tricked out. I don't even know how to say it. It's just, the story is just bananas. And you can find it online. It's a very famous story. It's the kind of story that you read this story and you're like, well, I'm never going anywhere in a foreign country by myself ever
yeah.
again. You know, like, you know. Well, so anyway, that's my first one.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of some of these, like in the early, like the 2000s or 2010s, there was like a series of like, you know, if you follow horror movies at all, like movies about like people who go to far-flung places and end up getting tortured, you know?
Yeah.
They called it torture porn, which is I hate terms like that where they just say blank, you know, yeah. blank porn, because I think that's.
Yeah, I don't either. Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like there was a series of movies where exactly this happened. Like people would go to some place, exotic place somewhere on the globe, and they'd be like, they'd just be there to have a good time. And you kind of wade into a situation where you have no idea what you're getting into. And, you know, you're like basically a tourist who just has no clue of what things are like on the ground, and trouble ensues, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's totally nuts. It's nuts.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. That's a crazy story. I remember it very well too. And the other thing this is just kind of an aside, but the way you describe, you know, I'd forgotten, you know, what ends up happening to this guy and how he kind of like spends time as part of like a show almost reminds me of that one. Remember the Coen Brothers movie, Buster Scruggs?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
there's one part of it where there's somebody who has something has happened to them. I don't want to say too much, but they've, you know, they've been altered. Or maybe, I don't know if intentionally altered, but there's somebody who has like, you know, their bodily form is different than what you and I, what your average person's is. And he has become basically kind of like a sideshow act.
Yeah.
You know? So you just wonder if that was kind of an influence on there or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah. So my first story, I've got a number of stories that, you know, I've never been able to forget. My first one is actually really kind of a, like, I don't know what to call it, but like the story you just described is kind of crazy, kind of a shocker almost, you know? And my first story is like that too, but I have to say that not all of my stories are like this at all, you know? And that's maybe something we could say, like, a story can be memorable for a lot of reasons. It doesn't, it's yeah. not necessarily because it has like some incredible twist at the end, although a couple of mine do, you know, but sometimes, as you'll see from my list, sometimes it's memorable for a completely different reason. And my first selection, you know, and I know that it's the last point I'm supposed to get to, but it's memorable. I'll say this, it's memorable to me because of how prescient it is and how ahead of its time that it was, but also because it has this incredible kind of like slam bang ending, which I'm not going to spoil. But it's interesting because I don't necessarily know. You can still hear me, right?
I can hear you.
Yeah. I don't necessarily know the year, the exact year that every one of my stories was written. I can give an approximation.
That's fine.
Yeah. I can give an approximation, like you said. But this one, I know exactly when it was written, because I just couldn't believe, given what this story is about, it's astounding that it was written in this year. So, but I'm kind of cheating a little bit because, okay, so the author is Ambrose Bierce, who's a very, you know, famous American writer and short story writer who kind of lived in around the turn of the century, from the 19th to the 20th century. And I'm not going to talk about this story, but his most famous story by far, that is one of the stories I was talking about before that almost everyone has heard of, if you've heard of famous short stories. It's called An Incident at Owl Creek Bridge. You remember mm-hmm. that one?
I don't remember it that well, but I do remember it.
Okay, it's his most famous story, very, very famous. And it involves a soldier who is, my memory is fuzzy, but I believe it takes place during the Civil War period. And I believe it's a Northern soldier, a Yankee soldier, who's being hung on a bridge way down in the South. And the story is basically just a description of his hanging. And, but it, I don't want to spoil it too much, but, there's a flashback element to the story where all kinds of things happen that get stranger and stranger and stranger. And then the story kind of builds up to the moment when the soldiers hang. But it's kind of a shocking story. It's very vivid. It's, you know, it's what he's most famous for. So that's, you know, one that people may be familiar with. And that kind of, you know, really put him on the map. But the story I want to talk about, written by him, it was part of an anthology I read many years ago. But man, like, I never forgot this story, not even close. And it's called Moxon's Master. So it's much, much less known. M-O-X-O-N, Moxon's Master. And you probably remember me talking about this book or this story, Jude. I don't remember if you ever read it. Do you know if you have?
I know the story. I can't remember if I've read it, but anyway, so yeah. I'm not sure, to be honest.
Well, okay. So I happen to know the year that this story was published, and it's a very significant fact to me because this story was published in 1899. And why that's so incredible is because literally the first, now I'm going to paraphrase, I don't have it in front of me, but the first line of the story, which is a line of dialogue, is somebody saying something to somebody else. And it's basically, it goes basically like this: are you trying to tell me that a machine can think? That's the first line of the story, written in 1899. And I mean, so I was blown away then. And of course, you know, I probably read it first maybe 10 years ago, but every year we continue to live, the idea of machine learning and artificial intelligence just becomes more and more a part of our everyday life. And again, 1899, that's the opening hook of the story. And it's which that right there should make your brain explode, you know, because he's and so the story is very short. It's only about, I think it's less than 10 pages, and it consists of a man who goes to the house or property of a scientist. I think they're both scientists, and they're basically having a debate about whether a machine created by human beings can learn to think, or can be built in such a way that it can learn, which is an astounding thing in 1899.
You know? Yeah.
Like, it's just unbelievable. And so they have this very, you know, very interesting kind of back and forth where the guy's like, well, you know, what do you mean by think? And so they start talking about think, and what do you mean by learn? And so this scientist that he's talking to is sort of explaining his own views on how you can build a machine that actually may, or how even existing machines actually may think in a way. And he also uses like examples of like, well, you know, some do plants think because some plants communicate with each other, or they, you know, the Venus flytrap or the sunflower turns its mind to the sun. So is that flower thinking in some way, even though it doesn't have a brain? And they have this fascinating kind of philosophical discussion that goes on for a few pages. But in the meantime, you're hearing these noises from another room, okay? And at one point, it's like one of the noises is described as like a rapping on the table, and you almost hear like a mumbling, you know? Like this is, again, 1899. So the guy, and he eventually starts talking about, you eventually come to realize that he has built and what they used to call an automaton, what we might call an android or a robot. And it's in the next room, you know? So like, you're just like, they're having this whole discussion. I can't remember. I wish I could remember better, but the guy who's visiting him doesn't go into the next room, but they reach a point in their debate back and forth. And he just kind of throws up in his hands and goes, you know, this conversation is not going anywhere. We can't resolve this. I have to go. I got to go meet some other friends. So he runs out of the place and he starts walking down the road. And again, being 1899, it's not like he's walking down a street with cars. He's walking through this path in the woods. And I'm trying to remember. Unfortunately, I don't. But something makes him turn around and go back. And when he goes back, he looks into the window, and he sees the guy who was just debating with, and he's playing chess against this automaton. And the scientist who created the automaton makes a move, and he cries out, "Checkmate!" And I'm going to leave it right there. It's like a cliffhanger as to what happens next. But this is all in the span of like 9 pages, and it has kind of a like I said, like a slam bang ending that you don't necessarily see coming. But man, my gosh, I mean, it's just such an entertaining and fascinating story. And I went back and I read it again. I'm like, wow, this is like, it has the punch of like an episode of like the Twilight Zone or something. But to be bandying about these ideas in 1899, ideas that are still very much being talked about in 2024, you know, that's insane. And it's like this really riveting, you know, kind of like, I don't know what to call it, but just kind of like just story with a huge, that packs a huge punch. And it's just awesome. Never forgot it. That one is available online too. You can find it pretty easily, and it's incredible.
Yeah. So I'm not going to talk about it a lot. I mean, I believe I have read it on your recommendation at least once, but what's the name of the story again?
It's called Moxon's Master.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely worth checking out. Yeah. That's all about like, you know, how long ago versus how still, you know, relevant, you know, the material seems. So that's a great one.
It's just hard to believe that a story like that was written in 1899.
Yeah, that is really hard to believe. So, but anyway, I'm gonna move on so that we can keep going. Okay. Yeah. And feel free to do the same thing. You don't have to react to like, if there's something you want to say about stories that I bring up, that's fine. But I'm just going to trust you and I do good job on our own to just sort of sell it to the listeners, you know? Yeah. So, my second story is called Safety Tips for Being Alone. Safety Tips for Living Alone. And that's the name of the story. The writer's name is Jim Shepherd, one of our favorite writers, particularly of the short story forum. One of our early episodes, again in the 20s, is what we call a dealer's choice episode on the work of Jim Shepherd. We probably talked about it during that episode. It came out in 2014. It was actually like a single. Oh, I hear a little echo now. You hear that?
I did not, no.
Okay. That's strange because I usually don't get it. It came out as like kind of an electronics single. You know, I think you can still get it as like a Kindle single or something or whatever that means. You can get it on like audio sites like audible.com. And then later it was collected into a book of his stories. I believe it's in his book called The World to Come, if I'm not mistaken. But this is a story about Jim Shepherd is well known for writing stories that are kind of rugged and adventurous, set at different time periods in different countries and different historical periods. This story happens to be about employees of a large like oil company who are given the work assignment to go out and spend like 3 or 4 months way out in the ocean on one of these like huge standalone oil rigs, you know, and there was like a series of them that were built in like the 50s or 60s called Texas Towers that I believe were out in the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. So this story is set on one of those Texas Towers. It's a Texas Tower number 4, whatever that means. And I think it was based on an actual historical incident, which Jim Shepherd also does a lot of, you know, writing about stories that are sort of based on historical events, like his famous story about the two guys on the Hindenburg, for example.
Yep.
You know, while it was going down. Anyway, basically, why this story is so unforgettable is that it's an absolutely white knuckle riveting story, basically about a guy or a number of guys, men, who get sent out to work on this Texas Tower in like the 50s or the 60s. And they're out there when a historically huge, horrible, vicious storm, like hurricane or whatever, tsunami or whatever, slams into Texas Tower number 4 and it basically destroys it. Like it rips it apart. And it's like this losing battle against nature, which is very characteristic of a lot of Jim Shepherd's short stories. He often writes about man versus nature and, you know, nature wins. And I won't say much more than that. It's just what I remember about this story is that it's so effective about setting up the circumstances around this collision between a massive vicious storm and this Texas rig. It's so vivid about the weather. It's so vivid about the details aboard this rig. I don't know how Jim Shepherd learned what he learned about how these guys work and live. And then there's a whole segment at the end where the storm is just slamming into it. And these guys are facing peril on the sea, you know, and it's incredibly white knuckle. It's incredibly tragic. You know what's going to happen. And when I got to the end of this story, it kind of, I don't want to give too much away, but it literally ends with a guy out there on this deck of this big, huge metal oil rig that's coming apart everywhere and turning around, and there's this gigantic wall of the ocean like heading towards him. And you're like, and the story ends, and you, I remember being like, oh my God, like that story was just incredible. It's just super powerful, riveting story about like a, just a, an unimaginable disaster at the sea, and it just places you there. You're like afraid for your life by the end of this story. So
yeah,
that story to me is unforgettable. Safety Tips for Living Alone by Jim Shepherd.
And that might be available online too. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I looked for a little bit. I couldn't find it for free, but a lot of these stories you can find.
And like you said, I mean, we had a whole episode on Jim Shepherd, and that story probably came up, but it reminds me very much of a story that was on my longer list that is very much in the same vein as what you're talking about, but it was about the Chernobyl disaster.
Yeah.
It involves these two brothers who are both involved in the work there. And so the story is about kind of their relationship, and it has kind of a tragic element to it, but it also describes in very minute and scientific detail exactly what happened when the whole thing melted down. And that's an absolutely riveting story too.
Yeah,
very much in the same vein. And he's just so good at that. Like you said, he takes a lot of like historical incidents like that, often involving science or engineering, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
And then he'll put like a very human face on, you know, he'll put a character in there and who you kind of empathize with while this incredible disaster is happening. And he's just so good at that. So both of those stories are riveting. But yeah, the one you're talking about, it kind of it knocks into you like one of those waves. Let's just put it that way.
It's a good way to put it. Yeah, yeah, it really does.
It really does. It just like, you know, lays you out. Well, speaking of being laid out, I'm going to continue to go here. My next story is a totally different vein than anything we've talked about before. It is not. It's very understated. It's one of the saddest stories that I've ever read in my life. I think one of the saddest stories anybody will ever read, and probably one of the saddest stories anybody's ever written. But it stayed with me completely. I've read this book. This is a famous collection of stories. I've read it a couple times, but this is the one story that I just could never shake fully. So the name of the story is called A Room Forever, and the writer is a young man by the name of Brees Pancake, who was a writer from, I believe, from West Virginia. And I think he's come up on this show before. He only published one collection of short stories, and then he took his own life, tragically. He was a young guy. Mm-hmm. And this story was probably written in the late 70s. I know his book, which came out after, it was a posthumous collection, came out after his death. So it was released in 1983. And it kind of has this like almost like a cult reputation. I mean, his reputation has grown, but he only has a very small amount of published writing. But just this one book has really kind of ensconced him in kind of the American literary canon anyway. I don't think he's that well known outside of America. I mentioned this before. This story has come up at least once before, but the musician and songwriter Mark Knopfler from Dire Straits and has had like a long solo career. He was talking, maybe about 10 years ago, about how he discovered these stories from Breece Pancake. He's from Great Britain. He'd never heard of him. He read this collection of stories and he was just absolutely, gobsmacked by them. And this same story called A Room Forever inspired one of his songs that's on one of his albums. The song is called River Towns. And I've mentioned that before, but it's just like, so for more than one person, certainly this is one of the stories that stands out from this collection. And why is it unforgettable? Well, I've already said it's one of the saddest things I've ever read. And it's simply that it's about, again, it's probably about 10 pages long. And all it is just a story about a young man who is just kind of a vagrant in a way. And he works on river boats. It's sort of not really clear exactly where he works, but it's somewhere in the West Virginia region or maybe in Appalachia. It's not really very clear. He rents a shabby room in what's called a flop, and his life is, he basically says, he goes from shabby river town to river town, and he works on a boat. And when the boat puts in to re-up or whatever, or get maintenance, he just kind of hangs around these really shabby towns. And this story is just a description of one of his nights in one of these towns. And he rents this very cheap room in a seedy hotel. And at one point he says, kind of heartbreakingly says, something like, maybe I'll be in this room forever. Maybe this is the last room I'm ever going to need. I've never had a home. And maybe this room is as good as it gets. Almost like implying like he's going to end his life. And this will be his last night on earth. So that's very heartbreaking. And that's kind of a running theme in the story. He eventually encounters a very young girl, brings her back to his room. There's a sexual encounter, but she's like tragically young, and he says something. There's a line in there that says something like, it seemed like she was only interested in the business end of things, but you just get the sense that she says like, I'm really new to this. I don't know how to do this. It's a very kind of heartbreaking scene. And then he kind of encounters her later as he goes back out later, and he goes to a bar, and she's at the bar and she's sort of getting inebriated with some other older men that she doesn't know. And he sees her in the mirror of the bar. And this is one of the lines that stayed with me ever since I first read it. He said, it says something like, he wanted to tell her that there's no way you can drink yourself out of this, or something like that. And that's a line that just lodged in my brain. And he's not just talking about that night. You can't drink yourself out of this, And through this, it's just a very compact story, but it's just, you get a sense of how, I'm not sure I've ever read or inhabited a character that's as alone as this guy is. And he keeps talking about, kind of talking a big game to himself. Maybe I'll get a woman tonight, or maybe I'll, tie one on over here. But he's basically just drifting around the town. And he makes that comment about, maybe I'll be in this room forever. And you pick up along the way that he's just, throughout his life, and he's a young guy, but throughout his life, he's kind of been kicked around from home to home. He's never really had a home. He's lived in foster homes. He's lived in group homes. And that's really it. That's the whole story. And then finally, at the very end of the story, he's like, it just says he drifts down to the river to see if the boat he's waiting for has come in or not. But it's just this, the way this story is written, this story just howls. You just feel an empty wind howling through the spaces of this story. And it's just a very unnerving, unsettling, and like soul-shaking description of one person's loneliness that just, I just never forgot it, and it just kind of like has banged around in my brain ever since I read it. So, and I read it again, and it was every bit as powerful this time. It's not happy, but man, it is really very, very powerful. So it had to be on the list.
Yeah. And I think there's something about, like the knowledge you carry into reading that story by Breece Pancake of what happened to Breece Pancake sort of contributes to make that story as memorable as it is. Brees Pancake was in my mind also because I've read that collection. I remember it probably – I want to say it's just interesting, this whole process, because it impacted you more than it impacted me. But I do remember there was so many story writers and books that I remember as being such good books, but I couldn't remember them as precisely as I remembered some other ones. So I couldn't necessarily put them on my list, but I totally remember that book. It's a devastating book. It's very worth reading, and it's just such a sad story of like the talent he had.
Yeah.
It went to waste.
And it's fascinating, right, the way you mentioned this before, like how a certain line might just stick in your brain. Maybe you have to be a certain kind of reader to have that happen. I don't know. But like you mentioned the line about the dogs. Here are bad dogs. And it's been years and that stayed in your brain. Well, in this story, when he looks in the mirror and he sees a girl and he says to him, he just wanted to tell her, you can't drink your way. There's no way you can drink your way out of this. I thought, oh my gosh. That was a line that just, I've just never forgotten that line. And what else is there to say?
Yeah, well, we're going to take a break right now. But like my next story is a similar one in that there are some stories on my list that I'm going to bring up where it was one sentence or even part of a sentence that I have literally never gotten out of my mind. I'm going to talk about one of those next, but can we take a quick break?
Nice teaser.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you've done this before. Yeah, let's take a break.
I don't know. Yeah. All right, we'll take a break and we'll be back.
Okay, we're back.
All right, we're back, John, as you just told me. My next story, I'm going to follow my format. This story is called The Safe, with an S, The Safe. The name of the person who wrote it is a regional writer by the name of Tim Gautreau, one of our favorites. Tim Gautreau would be worthy of a what is it called? Dealer's Choice episode someday.
No question about it.
He's an exceptionally good, not really well known at all. It's one of the reasons why this story is on my list. Not the only reasons. The reason is because of how good the story is. He's an exceptionally accomplished short story writer and novelist, and he primarily writes about people and characters that are in the American South, even more specifically like Louisiana, like kind of the Bayou region. So he has like three or four story collections. They're all excellent. Worth reading. He has about roughly the same amount, three or four novels, maybe four or five. One called The Missing, The Next Step in the Dance. There's another one called, what's that logging one?
The Clearing.
The Clearing, thank you. And they're mostly, almost all of his work is set in this region. I don't remember how I exactly got to this, but there was a short story that was published in the Atlantic magazine. They had it, well, one of us saw it and sent it to the other or something like that. And we had already become familiar with Tim Gautreau. Came out in 2006. That's the third item on my criteria here. They had a fiction issue. This story was published and it was called The Safe and it had the intriguing subtitle of A Junkyard Mystery. very Tim Gautreau. Like I said, he writes about people in the Louisiana region, often poorer or, sort of marginalized, sort of financially disadvantaged people living very simple, basic lives. Tim Gautreau is also a Catholic writer. And so he has kind of a Catholic sensibility, although his stories can be very dark and difficult, but they're also very humorous. He has a really sharp and funny sense of humor. So they're kind of tragicomic. This is one of the stories that I actually don't remember probably as much as even the others. It's what I do remember that I want to bring up. The reason why this story is memorable is because it concerns like just some of his typical characters, these people or this guy or this husband and wife, I don't even remember, that inherit this like textile or sewing machine like factory, something like that in an obscure part of Louisiana in the Deep South. I think it's set in like the 80s or something like that. It's like a, and it's very reflective of like an old America that's like now in shambles and dying away. And there's a lot of metaphorical, Southern kind of themes going on there. Basically, they inherit it. They got it. It's way past its prime. It doesn't even really exist as a factory anymore. They're going to tear it down. They tear it down in the process of tearing it down. this crane with a magnet, uncovers from this junkyard, this rubble from tearing this piece of inherited, you know, Americana down, this gigantic metal antique safe. It's like, I actually went back and looked this up. It's like 6 feet by 8 feet. It's a huge block of antique, a safe with a combination lock on it that they can't get open. The whole story is about the discovery of this safe out of junk. And it sort of very skillfully builds tension. It's a very simple story. It's about these people and their lives and what they're facing. And, you know, financially and otherwise, you know, it's a little depressing. And the whole, it becomes this mystery about what is in this safe. And you're reading the story. And Tim Gautreaux is such a gifted writer. Like, he writes beautifully. And he builds tension around just opening this damn thing to find out what's in it. And then I don't want to give too much away, but when the whole story, it's not a very long story, it's about getting this thing open. Of course, they finally get it open. And when they get it open, I'm going to have to spoil this to some degree. I don't know how many people would go find it anyway, but this story just blew me away. They pull out like an equally antique, if not more antique, sewing machine, like a really old sewing machine. That is like a one in a kind thing. It was built, you know, in a long forgotten time where people cared about their work. It's like specially crafted. It has these little flourishes on it in the metal and in the mechanisms that you wouldn't see today. And on the end of some like bobbin or part of the sewing machine that bobs up and down, there's a dolphin, like a sculpted dolphin. And it's just beautiful. And then when it gets to the end of the story, I'll never forget this, the very last line of the story. It's not even the whole sentence. It's just the last phrase. This the guy that discovers this is so moved by it. And like kind of there's a joy that fills him just by how beautiful this old sewing machine is. And that is all it is. And the last phrase of the story is, and the dolphin swam in his palm. And I'll never forget that. I was like, I've got to the end of the story and it was just this gorgeous last paragraph. And then that last line, the dolphin swam in his palm, and you could just feel like my heart was like buoyed by this story. And I thought that is an incredible piece of short fiction writing. And I was so, you remember this, John? I was so blown away by that story.
Yes.
I looked up where Tim Gautreaux was teaching and I sent him an email, a random email. I said, I'm a writer. I read your story. You know, I just found his like email address on like the website of the college.
Right.
You know, I was so blown away by it. I just wanted to write you and say thank you. And the guy, damned if the guy did not write me back. I wish I still had the email. And it was a very short email. It was very eloquent. It was like, thank you so much. And blah, blah, blah. And he said, I can't remember it. If I had it, I would read it. But it was, he just said in like one sentence what good fiction tries to do. You know, and he was just like, you know, I try to do this and I'm glad that this kind of touched you, you know?
Right.
I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that last phrase. And that's all I have to say about it. I hope people will seek it out. I don't think it's easy to find online. I tried to, but it would be worth finding. I don't even remember what book it's in, so I didn't even do my homework. But he only has a couple story collections. It would be worth finding it and reading the story of the safe.
Absolutely, it would be worth it because I think you may have been the one who found it and sent it to me, but I read it and had almost the identical reaction. I was just, you know, flabbergasted by the beauty of that ending. I think he does have a collected stories volume out there that I don't remember what it's called that it might be in, but
it's called Signals.
Signals
might be in that.
All right. Well, maybe it's in Signals, the book Signals, but it is well worth seeking out. I absolutely agree with you. And, I am not going to add any, and the way you described it is perfect, but that's truly a remarkable story. And he's an incredible writer. He has one of the stories that was on my long, long list. I didn't even write it down, but the title story from his collection, Welding with Children, is it's a really great kind of comic. Like you said, sort of tragicomic story that I've always remembered too. But what a great writer Tim Gautreaux is, man.
Yeah, and I just want to say one more thing. That story is just flat out beautiful. And the beautiful thing about it being so beautiful is that it's a junkyard mystery. That's all you have to know. It's beauty out of the mundane. And if you can't, well, I'm not going to knock anybody listening, but if you can't appreciate that, you know, I don't know how I can help you, you know?
So. Yeah, but that's a story that would resonate with anyone who's ever tried to create anything.
Exactly. Nicely said.
Yeah. Especially with your hands, but even otherwise, it's just about, you know, how something beautifully made can just stop you in your tracks, like the story does. You know,
yeah, the dolphin swam in his palm.
Yeah,
I dropped it.
Well, it's funny you say that because I was thinking when you were setting this topic up, I thought that these are like the stories that make you drop the book. You know? Like,
yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So my next story is another one of those, and I'm going to have a really hard time not going on and on and on about how great this story is, which I won't, but it's difficult. The name of the story is called The Mud Below, and you know where this is going, Jude.
Yeah.
The writer is named – huh?
I said go.
Yeah. The writer is named Annie Prue. We did an entire episode on her and her writing. And if you are familiar with her or you heard that episode, you know that she has three volumes of stories that she calls the Wyoming stories. And they're all set there. And this story was featured in the first collection, volume one of the Wyoming stories. That volume is called Close Range. And
probably the best.
Well, I've read two of the three. I have the third one. I just haven't read it yet. Have you read all three? You might have.
No, so I can't even really say okay. that, but the first one's awesome.
Yeah, the first one is my favorite so far. I'm just leafing through my copy here. I think this story was written sometime in the 1990s, or it may have been earlier, I don't know, but I'm going to say sometime in the 1990s. Why it's memorable? Well, do we have time for me to read basically every other paragraph in this story? And then that would help, you know, her writing, we've already talked about it. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
I'll say this, what makes this story so memorable to me is that aside from her writing, which is just astounding, like, and very, evocative, there are sentences that'll make you literally drop the book and have to pick it up again. I know I said this when we talked about her. I've spent a little time in Wyoming, not much, but I've been there 3 or 4 times. And so when I'll read her describing, and obviously she lived there and for a long time, when I read her describing what it feels like to even drive through parts of the state, I just think it's amazing. She really evokes what it feels like there. At one point, we said this, I know in our episode, she said that the landscape in Wyoming evokes a kind of spiritual shudder. And I would say all of these stories do that as well. And this one for me, it's about a young guy, and her character names are just for the ages too. We talked about this too, but this guy is named Diamond Feltz. And he's a young guy. He's she described, like, the words she uses for different types of people there. Like, she would describe Diamond Feltz as a local crotch scratcher. And she talks about crotch scratchers and brass nutted boys. And I wrote this, and like, when she described two
let it out, John.
she describes one throwaway line. She said these two crotch scratchers drive up with a pair of buckle bunnies in the back. Western girls. I mean, it's just freaking hilarious. But what I love about this story so much is that Diamond Feltz is a guy who gets introduced like a friend on like a drunken night. They work all day at literally castrating pigs. And he's like, "You want to do something fun?" And he takes him to the back of his farm, and he puts this young kid, Diamond Feltz, on the back of a bull. And the story is about how he basically falls in love with rodeo, and he joins the rodeo circuit. And what I love about this story so much is that it just totally immerses you in this kind of underground world of like rodeo across the entire Western United States. So, and it describes very eloquently, she writes it so powerfully, how it gets on the back of this bull. They're like, you're supposed to last 8 seconds. He's on there over 20 seconds. And she said, it's like, it was like, she describes how it was like it was like an epiphany for him. This experience was totally unforgettable. She says the experience was absolutely unforgettable and unbearably personal is the way she puts it. And something is triggered in him deep inside that he's never experienced before. And that's all he wants with his life from that moment on, is to be a part of this. And so, and it describes in great detail, you know, driving, you know, wide swaths of America from like Texas to Wyoming to Oregon to California to Oklahoma. In it, she describes how you're always like broke, you're always low on gas, you're always have at least, you know, several abrasions and like broken bones. And it just, she just kind of immerses you in this world in a way that I found just utterly fascinating and totally unforgettable. And that's really what this story is about. But it's also about, as is typical of the case with Annie Proulx, you know, you learn about Diamond Feltz and his life, and he has a missing father. And at towards the end of the story, like, again, a line that I will never forget, you know, it's something like, it says, I think in one of the last paragraphs, it says, it was all a fast, hard ride that ended in the mud. And so he's describing the rodeo, but he's describing everything too. Like at one point somebody describes, you know, the arena where you ride a bull. It says it's the sky above and the mud below and you and the bull. And it's just an incredibly, I mean, I just can't praise it enough how evocative this story is, what a fascinating world that he comes into is. And some of the injuries that he sustains are just horrific the way they're described. And other people who he meets on the circuit and some of the injuries they, you know, have had happen to their person is just incredible. And it's one of the most evocative stories that I've ever read. And I absolutely love it. I was just completely blown away by the story of the Mud Below. And, you know, anybody who reads it, it's just like being totally like going to another planet, just being totally immersed in a world that you knew nothing about, but the way she writes about it is just electrifying. So I'll just put the period there, but what an incredible story.
Yeah, that's a great one. Proulx is just incredible. Like, if you have any interest at all in getting immersed in other worlds like that, you should read her Brokeback Mountain, about the two cowboys that fall in love with each other, is probably, it might even be the most powerful story about human love that I've ever read, or certainly about, you know, which is amazing because it's about love between two. It doesn't matter. The fact that it's love between two men, it's like the ultimate story about having love and then losing it, how heartbreaking that is. It's one of the most powerful stories I've ever read, but yeah, you know, I remember the Mud Below and she just like between those two stories. I mean, if you read some of her stories, you'll know. Yeah, like she's an incredible writer, you know, and the only thing, other thing I'd say in that case, and this happens sometimes, you know, there are books that are affect us more, like when I was talking last episode about Starship Troopers, having been an infantryman myself, you know, your experience of Annie Proulx was a little sharper than mine because of your three or four times that you've been in Wyoming, you know, and I've never been there. So sometimes just your experience, like, you know, obviously puts a stamp on your experience of a story.
Yeah, so absolutely. Yep.
All right. So I'm trying to keep it moving. Did you want to say something else?
No, let's keep it rolling. There's plenty of other stories to describe or recommend.
Yeah. And I don't know if I'll get to all mine, and that's okay. You know, I'm just going in order. I feel like I do this every episode. I only have one story by a woman. It's not my next one. I read a lot of female writers, and there are many, many female short story writers that I greatly admire, but I just couldn't find one that really stood out except for the one I'm going to talk about, but that's not the one up next. This next one I'm going to have fun with this, John. I think I can do it pretty quickly. I think, even by our standards, because of how I'm going to approach this. This is one of the more famous stories on my list. But again, like the caveat is there are people I know, like our good friend Dave, great friend of the show, maybe our mother, possibly another great friend of the show, Karen. I don't know because I don't know her as well. But like there are some people who are going to hear me talking about a story like this and be like, what is Jude Lovell smoking? What is he on about? You know, a lot of our stories are dark. You know, these aren't obviously these are Jude and John's favorite stories, you know, but people are going to hear this and be like, there's a certain amount of the audience is going to be like, okay, whatever. So that's another reason I want to kind of try to keep it quick. But my next story is famous. It's called The Call of Cthulhu. It was written by H.P. Yeah. Lovecraft.
This segment is brought to you by Metallica.
And what year is The Call of Cthulhu? I don't even know. Gosh, I didn't do my homework. Hold on, I'm checking something quickly. Nah, I don't have it in here. I'm not sure when The Call of Cthulhu was. Early part of the 20th century. You have any idea? Anyway,
I don't. Can look it up. That sounds right. Sure.
Okay. Why is it memorable? Okay. I'm going to read a full paragraph from The Call of Cthulhu now. And at the end of this paragraph, I'm just going to say, this is going to make you laugh. I'm going to do my best. All right. And then I'll briefly just kind of say what I'm talking about as far as why Lovecraft and this story in particular is memorable. To me, this is like kind of the ultimate, like a kind of the quintessential H.P. Lovecraft story. And it's describing cops are like they're people that are looking for someone who's gone lost in way out in the bayou swamp lands of New Orleans in the middle of this story. And they're looking for somebody and they come upon these people way out in the middle of nothing, gross swampland, doing some kind of ritual. And I'm going to read a short paragraph. Only poetry or madness could do justice to the noises heard by Legrassi's men as they plowed on through the black morass toward the red glare and the muffled tom-tom drums. There are vocal qualities peculiar to men and vocal qualities peculiar to beasts, and it is terrible to hear the one when the source should yield the other. Animal fury and orgiastic license here whipped themselves to demonic heights by howls and squawking ecstasies that tore and reverberated through those nighted woods like pestilential tempests from the gulfs of hell. Now and then, the less organized ululation would cease, and from what seemed a well-drilled chorus of hoarse voices would rise in sing-song chant that hideous phrase or ritual. Finiglui milawanef Cthulhu relaya wagandagla fitagin. There you go. That's why the story is memorable.
I'm glad.
Nobody, John.
I'm glad listeners got to hear that.
I'm sure I mangled that language. Listen, H.P. Lovecraft is like this horror / supernatural terror writer. Nobody on earth, for my money, goes both literally and metaphorically further into the dark scrunge way underneath the earth or our souls or whatever we're all about than H.P. Lovecraft. His stories are very long, they're very dense, and they have paragraph on paragraph that are exactly like that. And for me, it's kind of a dizzyingly kind of hilarious, absolutely unforgettable, and like super fascinating experience because of what the hell was going on in this guy's like mind and soul to write stories like this. So, you know, if you're not into supernatural horror and terror, I'm sorry, but The Call of Cthulhu to me, with that little taste I gave you, is the ultimate Lovecraft story. It's got these these explorations based on these manuscripts found in a library that describe these trips out. It ended up way out in New Zealand, you know, in wow. Some weird island, like with, you know, a ritual and something crawling under the earth. It's bananas.
Yeah.
So anyway, that I'm going to leave it there, but that's why it's so memorable. So I apologize to anybody who thinks that's madness. It is madness, and that's why I love it. So
yeah, that's kind of the point, right? The madness is the point.
Yeah.
But I'm not totally surprised to hear that, you know, the story actually, you know, starts somewhere in like New Orleans and ends up in New Zealand, because this is a guy who wrote at the mountains of madness, where the most of the action, if not all the action, takes place down at the bottom of the planet on Antarctica. Yeah. So like,
yeah,
he went far and wide with his imagination and just, you know, conjured up, as you just so eloquently, you know, you ululated or whatever. Like he conjured up, you know, creatures and beings that are, you know, beyond the realms of perception.
Absolutely. I mean, he was just off the charts.
Well, I'll just say, and this is a good time to say it, one on my long list was another story by him, which is called The Color Out of Space. I don't know if you remember that one. But
yeah.
And it basically involves a meteorite that crashes on a farm in rural Massachusetts. And, well, the effects of this meteorite crashing to Earth, first you see it in the produce, and then all of a sudden, you know, animals start mutating. And there's a guy who, like, he has, like, this old ant that he, like, locks up in the attic. And at one point, you go up to the attic to see the old ant, and she's no longer the old ant. I can tell you that. She's become something totally different and is, like, locked up in this attic. And then there's this, like, incredible color that is, like, no other color that's ever been seen before, that just emanates from the ground and basically drives everybody insane. You know,
oh man, that's just, yeah, that's Lovecraft. But you're gonna go way off the edge.
Yeah, but like you're saying, like the imagination, just to try to conceive of, let alone write about, a color that doesn't exist. Think about that.
You know? Yeah. He was really phenomenal, but obviously it takes a certain type, you know.
Yeah. Well, my next story is very different than that. Like,
great.
This is the quietest story by far, in a way, on my list, and it's a very quiet story in general, but therein lies its power, I think. And this is a story.
I have one of those too, so cool.
Yeah, this is a story called Lions, Hearts, Leaping Does, which is pulled from an old translation of scripture. And it is written by J.F. Powers, who is, that's a name that's like almost completely out of favor now, like barely even known.
Yeah.
But in the middle of the 20th century, he was known as one of the prominent American writers of short fiction. And he had a couple novels too. There was a famous novel of his called Mort Durbin, which is about the death of a priest named Father Urban. And, you know, the title is like a riff on, you know, Mort d'Arthur, like the King Arthur story.
You ever read Mort Durbin, John? Sorry.
I think I have. I definitely have it. I think I have read it.
Okay.
But I don't. I don't remember a lot of it. I think it like may have won like the National Book Award or like Pulitzer Prize, or it was a prize-winning novel. Yeah. But J.F. Powers is kind of primarily known for writing stories and novels about Catholic priests and sometimes nuns. Although that's not all he wrote about. He wrote about golfers. He wrote about baseball players. He wrote about businessmen. But his most famous writings are usually center around Catholic priests. And he was another Catholic writer on this list. And this story is very simply, it's about an old Franciscan monk who's dying. And the reason it's so memorable to me and powerful is it describes what's going on in his mind as he's literally passing the threshold from death to life. So it's about, again, it's short. It's maybe 10 or 12 pages. And he's being visited by another Franciscan, a younger Franciscan, who comes and reads to him from this book, which is a book of like the lives of the popes. So he has him read like interesting passages about interesting popes who had strange histories. And so he'll come in and read a passage every now and then. And at one point he comes in and he brings him a parakeet, I think, some kind of a bird in a cage. But most of the story you're in the mind of the Franciscan who's grappling with, essentially grappling with the mystery of death. And now we're all going to be in that bed one way or another. So, but to so powerfully evoke what's going on in the mind of an old person who's literally passing away, we all think, you know, what am I going to be thinking about at that moment? You know, I've had some friends die this year, that, you know, who were not elderly, but you just think about them. What was going through my friend Brad's mind as he passed on? And this story attempts to describe that. But it's also, so it's very moving on that level. But it's also, you've come to find out that he has a major regret involving one of his brothers. And so he's grappling, and he's a Franciscan priest. So he's grappling with this major regret. He's grappling with his own sinfulness. He's grappling with his own tendency to try to seem holier than he is. And he's grappling also with just, you know, everyday mundane things that maybe bother him. But because he's a Franciscan priest, he's bringing everything up. He's sort of like living in this confessional mode, where he's trying, it's hard to describe, where he's trying to, at one point literally says, you know, he did his best. He tried with all his might to give up all his thoughts and just rest in God. And he failed, is what it says. But at the very end of the story, it's very moving. I find it moving. And he's surrounded by several Franciscans who are there to be there. They give him the last rites. They're there to basically usher him through the door. And yet you get his thoughts as how, like, one guy kind of bothers him. And then at one point, you know, that symbolically, you know, that somebody leaves the window open. Somehow the bird flies out of the window. And I remember there's a line towards the very, very end where, you know, he's looking. You picture this person who's hovering on the edge of death and taking the next step, whatever that ends up being. And he notices this priest who's a friend of his. He's looking out, trying to find the bird among the trees. And it says something like, you know, he wondered, you know, and the priest's name is Titus, who's looking out the window. He wondered when Brother Titus would just allow the bird to, you know, to be caught up into the snowy arms of God or something like that. So he used the word snowy, which I thought was interesting. But it's just, that's all it is. And it's very hard to describe why it's so powerful and memorable, but it's just, it's that moment that we all think about, but you're kind of, somehow he puts you into this guy's mind as he's trying to grapple with the mystery of death and also wrangle with his own sinfulness, if you want to use that term, or his own regrets, his own life. And it's just, I found it to be very, very moving and powerful, and it's always stayed with me. And I really can't describe it more than that. But all of this is done within like 9 or 10 pages, and I find that to be a remarkable feat. So that's, there it is, Lions, Hearts, and Leaping Does by J.F. Powers.
Well, I'm not really even going to react to it. I've never read it, but I do. I want to thank you for that one, because I've never heard of that story. I've heard of J.F. Powers. And that sounds like a great example of what we're trying to do here in this episode. So that sounds like a really good story. Definitely would like to check that out. So my compliments on that selection.
Yeah, thanks,
John. I want to keep it moving. I have 5 left, but there's 3 that I really want to get to. And, you know, the other 2 I don't have to get to. So that's fine. My next story is called Sonny's Blues. This is a great change of pace. This is probably the writer on my list that I know that I really can speak to with the least, knowledge or eloquence or whatever you want to say. But this is a very famous short story called Sonny's Blues. The writer is James Baldwin. The year that this story came out was 1957 originally. This isn't part of my criteria. The way I got it is I was assigned to read it in graduate school by 2 working writers. One was a poet, one was a novelist. They both assigned the story, and we had like group discussions about it. Wasn't the easiest story for me to understand. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. I heard a click. wasn't the easiest story for me to understand around the age of 30, which is when what I would have been around when I read it, but I've gone back and reread it a number of times. I'm going to tell you why it's really memorable to me, which is the following, and then I'm going to read a line from it that is not really connected to why it's memorable to me, but it's just a short two sentences that I found from the story that'll show you why James Baldwin, the famous African-American writer from the 20th century, is like the real thing, in case you weren't aware of it. I don't know a lot about James Baldwin. I have read some of his books. The Fire Next Time is his favorite, famous sort of long essay about racism in America from the, gosh, I want to say it's the 60s. Go Tell It on the Mountain, etc. You know, very famous writer. There was a great documentary movie about him called I Am Not Your Negro, you know, several years ago.
Yeah.
He was a great writer, controversial in some ways. The reason why Sonny's Blues, it's not the easiest story to read, it's not very long, is so memorable for me is that, John, how do you describe like a really powerful musical experience, both as a listener and as a performer? This story is about this guy named Sonny, who's a piano player who has been through a lot of drug use and tragedy from Harlem, set in Harlem in like the 50s or 60s. The narrator is Sonny's brother, who doesn't have a name in the story, but he's like sort of estranged from Sonny. He's telling this story. And it's about the relationship. The narrator has been through a lot of tragedy and loss. Also, he lost a daughter to something like leukemia or something like that. He's been through great sadness and loss, and he's estranged from Sonny. And basically it's about them and how they get along and the difficult circumstances they grew up under in Harlem. I think there's like an abusive or an alcoholic father. I might be wrong about that, but the story is leading to Sonny, the brother, is trying to overcome his disadvantages and all these bad things he's been through by turning to his real passion, which is playing the piano. And the story ends up in a jazz club where Sonny is performing with a three piece. And the most incredible thing about this story is there is a passage at the end of the story, maybe a page and a half, about the band performing and how Sonny, who's kind of young, is taken under the wing of this fatherly figure named Creole, who's the bass player. And they're playing on stage, and Creole is kind of taking him under his wing as they're performing. And Sonny falters on stage, and the band is like at the risk of like kind of capsizing. But then it describes in musical terms, from the brother's point of view in the audience, how Creole steps in as the bassist and saves the performance and coaxes Sonny back into playing for real. And the way that James Baldwin captures that in prose is unbelievable. Like if it's a story about how like it's tragedy, loss, darkness, lots of major adult themes, but it's also about music and how really performing music well can lift the soul. And that's why the story is so memorable. And I want to read a line from the story that does not really – it's not really indicative of that musical stuff I was talking about, John. But when I read it, you're going to see why I wanted to read it. And then I'll have that be my period. So this is a two sentences from Sonny's Blues by James Baldwin. For while the tale of how we suffer and how we are delighted and how we may triumph is never new – it always must be heard. There isn't any other tale for us to tell. It's the only light we've got in all this darkness. So that's my next one. Sonny's Blues, James Baldwin.
Yeah, you're smart. Just, you know, just don't even, just leave it there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously he was a great writer.
Well, yeah, and that you know, like he had this, his writing is very, very powerful. It has like almost a mythic or like biblical quality almost, or prophetic from The Fire Next Time. You know, I've read a couple of his books, but there is a real, I don't know, the word that comes to mind is authority in his writing that comes through his writing. That's just remarkable. But I've never read that. I'll just say that that sounds like an incredible, like an all-timer, like a story that just needs to be read, you know?
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one for me to write down for sure. So we'll keep rolling along. My next one is I did this on purpose because my last one was so quiet and kind of profound and drenched in mystery. This one is much more lighthearted and ribald and very, very, very funny, but also is a wonderful story that packs its own punch in its own way. And so this is from the Irish writer Kevin Barry, who I know you love and have brought, we brought up on this podcast numerous times. This story is just, it's awesome. It's hilarious. I'm just going to say from the outset, I think there still exists online. If you have any interest after I talk about this story in this story at all, you should see if you can find a recording of him reading this story with his, with his brogue. Oh my gosh. The first time I ever experienced this story was him reading it. And it is just hilarious. I wish I could sit here and like read some of the dialogue because it's just freaking hysterical. But to hear him reading it with his accent and his brogue. And the story is called Fjord of Killary. Killary, I'm not sure if it's fictional or not. It may not be. But it exists somewhere on the west coast of Ireland. And it's a story of a reasonably successful middle-aged Irish, I think he came from Dublin, and he poet, and he's like a professor and a poet who's achieved some success in his life. He says that at one point, he's like, as hard as it may be to believe, I've actually achieved some success in my life. I'm never going to get across how funny this story is, but dude, you know, I mean, God damn it, it's hilarious. It's a story about this poet. He decides like his kind of like his inspiration is sort of like dried up, and he's decided on kind of a whim that he's going to change his life. He gets sort of talked into a real estate agent, talks him into buying this old kind of like hotel bar / hotel that exists on this western coast in this area called Killary of Ireland. It's kind of shabby, kind of beat up, but it has some history to it. Like supposedly Thackeray, you know, stopped there. And he basically says, I got seduced by the whole story of it. And this whole thing was a horrible mistake because now I hate this place. I hate all the locals. And I'm just like, and I'm not writing any poetry. But it's about, and so he's tending bar and some of the locals come in. And it's as one guy says on the very first page, I have to read this because he's like, just the way this, you know, it's end of the fucking world stuff out there, I said. like the weather's horrible. And these people get kind of stuck in this bar because the weather's so bad. And he keeps saying to the locals, like, has this place ever flooded? And they're like, you know, in 18 years, this place has never bloody flooded. It's not going to flood tonight. And of course it does flood. So they all get stuck there. And it's about this kind of drunken night at this hotel while you know, the weather is just going bananas outside. And eventually the story turns into kind of not just a beautiful kind of communal moment, but the way he finishes it. I'm going to read a little bit from this one because it's just so funny. But it's short, but I love in the very last paragraph here, he works in some Irish history. And he's talking about how they're basically going to survive the night. And he, the guy, the barkeep, the guy who owns the hotel realizes that, you know, for some reason, this night has stoked a fire in him again, and he may start writing again. It says 1648 was a year shy of Cromwell's landing in Ireland. And already the inn at Killary Fjord was in business. It would see out this disaster too. Now random phrases and images came at me. The sudden quick fire assaults that signal a new idea. And I knew that they would come in sequence soon enough. Their predestined rhythms would assert. I felt a new quiet ecstasy take hold. The gloom of youth had at last lifted. That's the final line of the story, but it kind of gives you a flavor of his writing, but that's all it is. It's just a story about these, you know, people sort of drunkenly, you know, gutting out this really incredibly rainy and wet night in this old hotel. But it's just, the characters are so funny and the dialogue is cracking. And it's just one of the most entertaining stories that I've ever read. I read it again. I was cracking up through the whole thing. It's about 10 pages. And again, if you can find him reading it, he gives all the voices like the right amount of salt and vinegar and flavor. And, you know, it's a little bit ribald here and there. And, but, you know, it has some serious moments too. It's just, it's fabulous and just really, really entertaining. It's from a book called Dark Lies the Island, which the whole collection is really great. I mean, Kevin Barry is just so gifted, dude. You've talked about him before. But
oh, yeah.
I never forgot Fjord of Killary because it's just so funny. So what a great story. I really, if you're intrigued by that description at all, see if you can find a recording of him reading it. I highly doubt you'll regret it.
Great one, John. Yeah, guys, listeners all around the world, if you like fiction, contemporary fiction, go read Kevin Barry. Like either his novels or his short story collections. And he's coming out with a new novel that's an American Western. I'm so excited about that. I can't even contain it. Kevin Barry is an incredible writer. And John is absolutely right. If you can hear him, even in an interview, go find a podcast or go find him reading a story. I'm sure you can YouTube him reading a story, maybe this one. It will definitely be worth it. You know, Kevin Barry's awesome. So that's a great one.
He'll teach you new phrases like, I don't give a fucking monkeys. And like monkeys apostrophe S. It's like, what does that mean? I don't know. But, you know.
His novel, City of Bohan is one of my favorite books. You know, I'll just leave it there. Go check it out.
Yep.
Okay, I want to get to two more, and then I'll do like a super speed round at the end, and maybe you will too. But there's two more I want to get to, so I'm going to proceed so we get to them, and then you can get to whatever
you're going to get to. Are you going to do the two right now, or are you going to do one and then let me do one more, and then
– I was going to do one and volley it and then come back to the second one, but do you want me to do it – you know, do them both?
No. That's cool. Just wanted to see what you're going to do.
Okay, yeah. My next one is one of the darker stories on my list, and a lot of the stories are dark. This story broke my heart, basically, into a million pieces. Kind of like the DJ Pancakes, Breece, DJ Pancake story. And it's the only one on my list that's by a woman. The name of the story to follow my format is called The Trespasser. It was written by a woman who's still writing today, a great writer named Bonnie Jo Campbell. She's like also a regional writer, like the upper Midwest, like Michigan.
Yeah.
Those regions up there. It's from her award-winning, I think she won the National Book Award or something for her collection of stories called American Salvage, which I know is one of John's favorite story collections.
Yeah, that's incredible.
And I not only won't I talk at length about it, I can talk at length about it. I talked earlier about being a dad to two daughters. This story is about 5 pages long. You can find it online if you want to read it, if you have the stomach for it. It's on, you can find American Salvage on Google Books, and it's the first story in that collection. You can just read it. It's like 5 pages. It'll take you 5 minutes or 10 minutes. But it's not for the week. It's just about, and I found out from this was the first story I read by her, and it just broke my heart. You know, it's set in Michigan. It's about this sort of, a lot of her characters like Tim Gautreaux, not that well off. There's a lot of meth, financial difficulty, broken families, drug use, tragic stuff, dark stuff. These people in this story called The Trespasser have a little shack somewhere up in Michigan. They arrive there with their teenage daughter, it's quickly made clear that she's like a more privileged teenage girl than many in the region. They arrive there to spend some of their summer there, and they find that their little cabin has been sort of ransacked by like squatters who are burning crystal meth. So a lot of the story is kind of the detritus from these people taking over their home. They go in, they're cleaning up, a lot of the story is told from the point of view of the more advantaged teenage girl, their daughter, who's coming in and kind of discovering things. But it switches to the people who were in the shack before they abandoned it. And the last person who abandoned it was there by herself for a day or two, and it was a teenage girl around the same age. So it switches into her mind kind of in the past before she left there, and some of the stuff that it's heavily implied she went through at the hands of two or three much older men who were like drug addicts cooking meth in this house. It's not explicit. It's just implied that she, this young girl, heartbreakingly young girl, 13 and 14, has been through some bad stuff in that house. She kind of escapes on her own at the end and is just wandering through the woods. In the story, she's last seen in like a rowboat that she finds on like a river, and she's floating to some indeterminate future. The girl who was occupying the house before the family got there. But the very end of the story is the family kind of going through the whole house and going out the back door and finding an abandoned mattress on the back porch. And the description of what is to be found on that mattress is horrifyingly vivid. I don't want to say it. And tells you everything you need to know about what went down between like three drug addict older men and a 13 or 14 year old girl. And then the story kind of ends. And I like couldn't even believe it when I finished that story. I was so heartbroken by it. Yeah. And I thought, oh my gosh, like, and it was not, so I want to just mention briefly, it was, I know that's so dark and really difficult. And I was really frightened for my teenage daughters at the time. I was reading it sort of like 4 or 5 years ago when my daughters are older teenagers and just entering their 20s. I was just kind of, you know, frozen by that story, but it was also the power of the writing, the understatement. She didn't give you anything you didn't need, but she gave you some vivid words describing what was on that mattress, and your imagination can do the rest. So because it was so shattering to me, I respect it greatly. So that's why The Trespasser by Bonnie Jo Campbell is one of my unforgettable short stories.
Yeah, that's a really rough one. But yeah, that book is incredible, and most of the stories are almost as indelible as that one. You know, they really hit you in the face with some really difficult realities. That's a great one. But you definitely need a strong stomach for that one. The last one I want to mention, and I'm not going to do this story justice because it's been a long time since I read it. I did not get a chance to revisit it. I really wanted to, but it's always stayed in my memory, so I had to mention it. And it's, you know, I guess it's, you could file this under niche interest, you know, because a writer is a Japanese Catholic writer. So it's another Catholic writer story on my list. I realize I have two or three of them, but that aligns with my interests. So. But this story's fascinating. I read it many years ago. I've never forgotten it. And the writer is Shusaku Endo. The story is called Mothers. I don't know. It's from his one. He might have more than one. Probably does. But I know translated into English, he has one short story collection that's called Stained Glass Elegies. I don't know. Do you remember if you've ever read that?
I might have.
Yeah.
You know, it's been a long time.
Just curious. But anyway, this is probably, I'm going to, in terms of when it was written, I'm going to guess 60s or 70s, maybe 1960s. But Shusaku Endo is best known for having written the novel Silence, which was in recent years made into a film by Martin Scorsese. Very powerful book. It's come up on the show before, on this show before. Yeah.
Right.
He was a Japanese Catholic, as I said. He and this story has elements of his autobiography, let's put it that way, because he was raised pretty much alone by his mother. His parents split up. His mother was Catholic. His father was not. But he kind of was raised with these two kind of an older Japanese tradition and like the Catholic tradition. And they were always kind of at war with each other within him. And so it's a large part of his writing. Much of his writings kind of deal with Catholicism and in Japan specifically. And this story is no exception to that. So the story's called Mothers. It involves a guy. I can't remember why he's going, but he visits an island that's off the coast of Japan. And there's a Japanese word for it. I don't remember, but there's a word for underground Christians who kind of worship Jesus, you know, believing Christians, but there are no priests that are part of their community. So they have their own kind of underground community where they continue to kind of hang on to their Christianity or a type of Catholicism, but there's no one there to kind of say mass, give them the Eucharist. So their communities have evolved kind of their own traditions that are mixed in with more Japanese traditions. There's a Japanese word for it. Anyway, this man in the story visits one of these communities that's off on this windswept island off the coast of Japan. I don't remember what it's called, but it's a very, you know, they like literally, you know, some of their activity is in like caves, and they're just kind of a poor Christian community that's like clinging to the rocks, basically, literally. And the description of this island and how he gets there and the weather there is really, really vivid. I remember that. At the same time, the story talks about the narrator's or the main character's relationship with his mother, who was a Catholic, who raised him as a Catholic. So this is sort of the, you know, autobiographical element and, you know, his feelings about his Catholicism. And I just remember him visiting this community. There's a shrine or a chapel on the island that's to Mary, the mother of Jesus. And so he goes and visits that, and there's, you know, some kind of ceremony that he witnesses there. And he ends up leaving the island, I remember, with some kind of relic that's like a local kind of carved statue of Mary. And they're constantly apologizing, like it's very crude, it's not very good, but it becomes this like famous, or not famous, but this very meaningful kind of talisman for him. And it's just a story about him visiting this community, this fascinating community that exists on this island that I guess reflects, you know, a reality that was once part of Japan, maybe still is, I don't know. But it's a really interesting juxtaposition of like Japanese culture and Catholicism, and also his relationship to his own mother. So there's, you know, it's very kind of, even though it's, you know, it's Christianity, it's Catholicism, but it's a very kind of maternal vision, I guess, of Christianity. And it's very sort of mother-centric. It's just a fascinating, to me, it's just the way the story's written. It was just a moving and fascinating kind of blend of cultures and his encounter with these Christians who are literally kind of like clinging to their beliefs on this like windswept rock. I found it just to be fascinating, and it's lingered in my mind ever since. So I'd really like to go back and research that story. I do know that some people think it's among the best things that Endo had ever written, and that's saying something because Silence is an incredible novel. He has a bunch of other novels that are really powerful. But this story, Mothers, and it's long. This one's longer. I think it's like maybe 30 pages. Would be worth tracking down someday. It's just a really interesting look at who Endo was, but also again this kind of mix of cultures that I found really, really interesting. So I had to mention it because it's kind of unlike anything else on my list. So that's my last one. I have a longer list that I wanted to just read off, just to kind of recommend some more stories. But I'll pass the ball back to you.
Okay, so that was a great one. Shusaku Endo was an awesome writer. And, of course, he had this really close relationship with his mother. She was the one who was a Catholic. They kind of made him a Catholic. So, like, right. Mothers and the spiritual matters relate heavily to a lot of his work, you know. But, yeah, I have one left that I want to bring up. I'll do it quickly because we're approaching the two-hour mark. And then we'll do, like, a really speedy speed round just to throw some other stories at you. And then we'll wrap up. So my last story, it's an audible because it's the same writer that I was going to talk about, but I'm shifting because I'd rather end on something that's not quite as dark as some of the other ones I ended on. Mm-hmm. And it's also a shorter story, so I can cover it quickly. The name of the story is Nebraska, and the writer is Ron Hansen, one of my favorite writers, you know, like the – Mariette and Ecstasy is a novel I frequently cite as one of my favorites of all time. It's written by Ron Hansen. Again, another Catholic writer has written some short stories over his career, but is more famous for novels. And he's now also a Catholic deacon. He's in his 70s. He's kind of in the twilight of his career, but he's one of my favorite writers of all time. Early on in his career, when he was a young writer, kind of emerging, he published a book of short stories called Nebraska. This is the title story. I recently reread Nebraska. I think Ron Hanson is very spotty as a short fiction writer, to be honest. He's not one of these writers to me that you would read for your short stories, with a couple exceptions, but more for his novels. Nebraska, in my first experience, and also reading it, rereading it just recently, had the same experience. The first story is called Wickedness. I almost talked about that. It's about a massive snowstorm in the latter part of the 19th century in Nebraska. White knuckle, unforgettable, kind of like his friend Jim Shepard. But the last story of the book is called Nebraska, and I'm going to focus on that one because it's a really beautiful story. It's really not much of anything, except it's an homage to Ron Hanson. It's from Nebraska. It's kind of like somebody in a slow-moving car or walking, going through a small town in Nebraska and just describing little everyday scenes of just totally mundane stuff in Nebraska. But the whole story, and it's about 7 pages long. Every paragraph in it is beautiful. It's kind of just jumping from woodline to lawn to birdbath to, you know, John, I can't do it justice. John Buckley, 93 years old, drags his garbage pail out to the end of the drive. It's just a walk through small town America in the middle of the country, in the middle of the 20th century. And it ends up with towards the end, I remember it's kind of like a camera or like a, you know, indeterminate narration. Doesn't even have to be human. There's a scene at the very end with one phrase that I've never forgotten since the first time I read the book, talking about a woman with a garden hose spraying her flowers in the front yard. And it describes the water from the hose as an inverted crystalline bowl. I never forgot that. You know, like I could see it glittering in my mind.
Yeah.
You know, in this lawn in Nebraska. That the story is jammed to the gills with that kind of writing. And then the last line I've always remembered, I remembered it the first time, I remembered it the second time. It's talking about an old woman sort of in her house or whatever, and it says something like in a world where such and such happens, comma, in a country she knew by heart. And that's the end of the book. And it's just this beautiful tribute to Nebraska. And it's like walking through a series of beautiful paintings about small stuff. So I love that story. I was just really impressed with it the second time I read it. Also worth reading if you can find it. It's like a 7-page story, and it's just beautifully done.
Well, I can find it because it's up in my shelf upstairs. So I'm, you know, you're inspiring me to go and reread that sucker. It's like sometimes a shorter story when it's beautifully written like that, it's really closer to poetry almost.
Yeah, prose. Very close. Yeah.
Yeah. Or related. But yeah, I too have read that book. I too think the two standout stories are the beginning and the end, the wickedness in Nebraska. It's one of these stories that you probably have to experience to really see how powerful it is. But that makes me want to read it again. So
I recommend you do. And so I'm hitting the ball over. Why don't you give us a real quick, just, you know, machine gun fire of some other stories you want to just put in people's minds. And then I'll do the same thing. And then we'll go right on to what we're going to read next and tease episode 67 really quick.
Yeah, cool. All right. This is my longer list. I'll mention the stories that I haven't talked about. The first story that popped in my head when we talked about this topic, I did not discuss, but it's Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe. And if you've read that story, you'll know why, you'll know very well why it's memorable. But if you've never read that story, you basically turn this off and go read it because the end of that story is unbelievable. That's, you know, an all world story for a reason. I'm just going to give like 10 seconds on each story here. Another one was from one of your favorite writers, Tooth and Claw. T.C. Boyle has so many stories, you could pick any one of them. But I have always remembered T.C. Tooth and Claw, about a guy who basically wins like a leopard or some kind of wild cat in like a bar bet and brings it home. And, you know, it's not too much to say that that doesn't go particularly well. oh, I forgot one of my stories completely. Oh, what a shame. That I was going to discuss, and it's Roman Fever by Edith Wharton. I know you can find this online. This is basically a conversation between two women, but within the course of like 8 or 9 pages, again, where you get like kind of this whole life story, and you realize that they have had this lifelong rivalry, and it ends with a punch to the gut. Like literally, the last line will make you drop the book. It's an incredible story, Roman Fever. I recommend people seek it out, by Edith Wharton, who's a great writer. Jude, one of your stories is on this list. It's called The Races. Oh. It's called The Races. I absolutely love that story. Again, it's a story. It's a beautiful story, but it has a gut punch at the end of it. It's about these young kids. And the first time I read it, well, I will always remember the first time I read it because I didn't see it coming and it like punched me in the nuts. Sorry to say, but, love that story.
Thank you.
Daphne du Maurier wrote the original story that the movie The Birds is based on, but it's very different than the movie. And I think it's a lot better. It's fascinating, really creepy. Takes place in this like rural part of England. It's nothing like the movie. Seek it out. It's awesome. There's a really memorable story by a guy named Alan Sillitoe called The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. This is one of the most famous like British stories in the last like 100 years. Really powerful story. Let's see. The entire book of Sherwood Anderson, Winesburg, Ohio. I've talked about it before. What else? I'll leave that one to you. I think you're going to bring him up. To Build a Fire by Jack London, which is an amazing story, very famous. Has an incredible ending. 310 to Yuma by Elmer Leonard. It's just a wonderful Western story. I just read it recently for the first time, and I loved it. And the last one is a story, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien's very famous for many things. He has a short story, though, called Leaf by Niggle, which is a fascinating kind of look at creation, basically. And it's a really interesting small story by him that if you've never heard of it, it might be worth checking out, seeking out as well. Leaf by Niggle by J.R.R. Tolkien.
Oh man, great closer there, man. Way to stick to landing.
Yeah, that's my list, although there's zillions more.
All right. Well, my quick hit list is Wickedness by Ron Hanson, the story, incredible story about a snowstorm that I just mentioned from the 19th century. A Good Man is Hard to Find by Flannery O'Connor is one of the most famous, but it's canonical American fiction.
Yep.
With a kind of a jaw-dropping ending. If you haven't read it, you know, No One Writes to the Colonel is a longer – it's really a novella, but it's by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the great writer from Colombia, which has – it's a really memorable story in a lot of ways. But it has, the last word of the story is awesome. So – and you're going to have to go check it out if you want to check that out. It's called No One Writes to the Colonel. I also have a T.C. Boyle story called Descent of Man, which is kind of similar in – theme to the one you brought up, Tooth and Claw, which I also remember really well, where, again, Boyle is somebody who wrote about man versus nature, and a man loses every time. Let's just put it that way. Yeah. You know, Scent of Man is a great story with a very classic first line of the story. The Judgment by Franz Kafka is a signature story in my life. It's very dark. It's about basically really troubled relationship between a father and a son. Definitely worth reading.
Oh yeah.
Awesome horror story by a female writer that's not very well known. It's called The Thing in the Woods, and it's by A.S. Byatt, an English writer who's deceased now, but was best known for the novel Possession and many novels. Great writer, but she wrote a little curious little book of horror-esque stories called The Little Black Book, the first story in that called The Thing in the Woods is very memorable.
Wow.
Com-Com is an office satire by George Saunders, hilarious writer, but also has some like crazy, you know, developments in it. George Saunders is very creative and, you know, his stories can go way over the, off the rails, but are also, he's very funny. Definitely worth reading. Jerusalem's Lot is a really early short story by Stephen King. That's very Lovecraftian, but it's a really effective story with vampires that kind of led him to his similarly titled novel called Salem's Lot. But the original short story, Jerusalem's Lot, in one of my favorite story collections called Night Shift, is worth reading. I really wanted to talk about this story, but didn't have time, called Car Crash While Hitchhiking by Dennis Johnson.
Yes.
I'm gonna say, like Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio, people should just read the entire book. Yes. One of the seminal short story collections of the late 20th century, for sure, is called Jesus' Son. And Car Crash While Hitchhiking is like a 6 or 7 page story that's just ingenious, although very mysterious.
Yeah, you dropped the book with that one. That book's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, with the incredible last line, you ridiculous people, you expect me to help you. Okay, thanks. You know, and then a story I really wanted to talk about at greater length, but just I didn't have time to, Bartleby the Scrivener by Herman Melville. Incredible short story. Maybe one of the earliest kind of office stories in the world. Very famous. People should read it for sure. And then the last one I just want to mention is a story I haven't talked to you a lot about. It's from the last story collection I read by the great Ron Rash. I've talked about him. Great novelist and short story writer. He can do both really well. In America, who writes in the Appalachian region. He's the guy who wrote the novel Serena. His last book that I read, called In the Valley, has a story about a really old World War I veteran who dies in the course of the story, but he leaves in his room. I don't know if I'll ever forget this. He leaves behind these paintings he worked on for most of his adult life in this little shack he lives in. And the paintings are his imagined recreations of cave art that he saw on one day of leave while serving in France during the First World War. Wow. And he works on recreating this art on the walls of his room for the rest of his life. And then his like great granddaughter or something is called in to kind of assess his house and discovers these paintings. Incredible story. It's called L'Homme Blessé, like the blessed man.
Wow.
Great story. You should read that sometime, John. So that's the end of my list, and we'll keep right on rolling, John. Unless you have something else to say about short stories, do you want to hit on, you can bring it up now. And then at the beginning, why don't you talk about what you're planning to read next?
Well, I can be very fast, 'cause I actually haven't even figured that out. I don't have an upcoming read figured out yet, 'cause I'm still kind of immersed in this book by William Dalrymple. So. And no, I think we've covered the subject. So I guess I'm just going to kick the ball back to you. You know, like I'm not. It's like a soccer game. I got two or three guys around me. I'm not really open. So I'm going to have to kick it back.
Well, that's fine. I do have something lined up. I think we did a reasonably good job of covering definitely some of our favorite short stories today. Very hard to cover all this stuff in one episode. Jeez. So, you know, but hopefully we gave people some good tips if you want to read some cool short stories. For me, coming up next, I'm John kind of crept into my skin and took over, because I'm doing like a fairly unusual longer nonfiction read coming up next from a writer that really fascinates me by the name of William T. Vollman. He writes these gigantic novels and nonfiction books, but he's written a 2-volume discourse on basically man's destruction of the environment through like fossil fuels. The first volume is focused on nuclear power, and I'm about to read the first volume, but the second volume is focused on coal and like fossil fuels themselves. Both discuss these subjects by, he's very famous for traveling and doing extensive research. So he goes around the world for both books. And he's very clear at the beginning of the first book that they're intended to be one long work, but his publishers just wouldn't publish it because the first book is like 700 pages and the seventh book is similar length. The first volume is called No Immediate Danger. The second volume is it's escaping me now. Crud. I always forget the second volume. But the whole work is called Carbon Ideologies. And it's an exploration of how we are like destroying the planet and exactly how we're doing it and what, if anything, can be done. But in the first volume, No Immediate Danger is a phrase that comes from a report that came out shortly after the gigantic tsunami hit the Fukushima or something like that. I'm mangling it. Nuclear power plant in Japan, off the coast of Japan, and just destroyed it and caused this massive, you know, nuclear environmental disaster. There was a report that came out and the catchphrase was no immediate danger. And so William Vollman is kind of using that in a very satirical sense. And I get the sense that a lot of this book is kind of like, you know, sorry, you know, future, we blew it, you know, like kind of like dark and sarcastic, but it's also, I know Vollman is very serious about his books and his research. So I think a lot of it's going to be over my head, but I'm really looking forward to it. Touches a little bit on, I work for a company that works in environmental remediation cleanup. So touches a little bit on the work that I do today, but it's mainly just out of curiosity. So No Immediate Danger, William T. Vollman is my next read.
Well, I would say you're in plenty of immediate danger. Because, like, he ain't going to survive that book, pal.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Like, your danger is very immediate, and you're going to be overwhelmed. But so good luck. But, no, that'll be, you know, fascinating. I'm sure it'll be challenging, but fascinating. So
yeah, you're right. I am in immediate danger because I'm not up for this read, but I'm very curious about it. So we'll see how it goes. And then, why don't I just put you on the spot, John? Our episode 67 is coming up. We're going to continue in a series. Do you want to tell our listeners what that's all about?
Sure. We just kind of decided that today. We have an occasional series that's called Read Around the World, where we focus on, you know, books by writers from a certain region of the world or about that region or some of the plot of the book takes place there, anything kind of connected to a certain corner of the home that we all share is what this series is about. So we've done two of them so far. One was about Australia. One focused on Australia and New Zealand. The second one focused on Mexico. We're now going to do the third one. This was chosen by my co-host here, Mr. Jude. And the focus is Iceland. So totally different part of the world from the first two parts of the series, and it's a much more narrow kind of pool. But we're going to see what we're going to look at, what we have read, maybe what we might want to read before this episode, and just kind of explore Icelandic culture through some of its books. So we're looking forward to strapping on our, you know, seatbelts and our armchairs, so to speak, and traveling to Iceland for our next episode, whenever that does come out.
Yeah, might be a little while we prepare for it. And John, you pointed out to me, like, well, there might not be a whole lot of writers, and that's true. But one of my favorite books ever was written by somebody from Iceland.
Yep.
So I'm definitely going to revisit that book. And there's a great writer from our yours and mine reading past, like sort of early 2000s, that we read a lot of books from Iceland, so we'll talk about him, and then we'll look into what else we've seen or want to see. There's also the great Icelandic sagas that I've never read a word of, but a very famous literary tradition there. So, yeah, it's going to be wild, but I just figure even if we don't have a lot to discuss, we'll share our experience from what we've read of the literature of Iceland, so it's going to be great.
Well, and I know I've read at least one book about Iceland, so there's that. And what I recommend you do is after you've, you know, kind of quickly traipsed through Vollman, you could just cram in after that, like 9,000 page book from Vollman, you could just cram in the entire volume of Icelandic sagas and just, you know, just be ready
right
for in a couple of weeks. So that should be fine.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, you know, I won't see you on the other side probably, but, you know.
Again, the danger is immediate. But we are in immediate danger of wrapping up this episode, I think. So, and it's been a long one. So, like, I think it's about time.
Yeah, we got to end it. But it was great, John. Great discussion. And certainly worthwhile to do a long episode. But we're going to sign off for now. We want to thank everybody around the world for listening, as we said at the beginning. And I hope you all have a great couple of weeks coming up until we meet again.
Yep. Have a great one. And we will talk to you again on episode 67.
Bye-bye.